And I like to start with the Torah because it seems like a very good place to start. And in particular, taking a look at Abraham. And there's a few reasons for this. First is kind of it's selfish is the wrong word, but I happen to know the Abraham story very well because for 2 years I taught at MIMO. I taught 11th grade Chumash, and the focus was I mentioned this to a few people already when I had another share where I spoke about Abraham. The focus was the first half of Sefer Bereshit. So that was four periods a week, meeting for, 45 minutes at a time, and devoted to 22 chapters of Sefer Bereshit. You just develop this instinct to eke everything possible out of the text of the Torah so that you can, find as much as possible. So that led to me having a real good command of the first four parashiot of the Torah. After that, once we get to Chaye Sara, I am completely ignorant, but at least, I will milk these parashiot for as much as I can while I can. So I really know the Abraham story well. And something that I learned in the process of having to prepare and really focus on the Abraham story was I learned to pay really close attention to the story, particularly to look at the various lenses and through which we can read the story. The truth is, when we think of the stories in the Torah, if I asked everyone to recount the Abraham story, I imagine most people would hit most of the basics. Abraham is a pretty well-known figure. His narrative is pretty well-known. It's not like I'm asking you, tell me what happens in Parashat Tzav. And then everyone's like, I don't know. Tell me what happens in Parashat Lech Lecha and Vayera. Everyone has a rough idea of the major scenes that take place. But because of that, we tend to skirt over the narrative. We assume we know what it's talking about. We don't really look at it for too much depth. The parasha cycle is one of the most beautiful things we have because it ensures we learn through the entire Torah in a year. But it's also terrible because it forces us to have this very surface level understanding of each and every parasha. We devote, at best, if we're doing Shnai Mikra Ve'echad Targum, if we're fulfilling our obligation to, read through the parasha twice together with the translation, okay, so within 1 week, we read the parasha twice and then a translation, that's the best we can do. Maybe 20 minutes a day is what most people are doing to have a high level of parasha study. It leads to a very surface level understanding of the parashiot and to the story. And most of the stories within the Torah demand far more attention than that. What we're going to do over 3 weeks, and this is in partly to show and illustrate how much can be learned from just close reading the Torah, we're going to focus on one lens. And I titled it, Desperation and Frustration, Abraham's Search for a Successor, because the lens that I want to talk about today, there are many lenses through which to view the Abraham story, is one that I don't think we talk about enough, which is Abraham really wants a kid. And yeah, we know that. That's kind of the obvious plot point of the entire story. But we don't focus on how many of the vignettes we get of his life are devoted to that. And we don't often pay attention to how much that motivates some of the key stories in his life. The second thing we'll also get to see here is that Abraham actually gets frustrated with God pretty often. And this is what we're going to be devoting some of the time today to understanding is actually the relationship Abraham has with God, which isn't maybe what we think. When we think of Abraham's relationship with God, we imagine this idealized religious figure who has this almost perfect relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Peshat of the Torah, just paying careful attention to the words themselves, seems to yield something very different. And so that's something that we are going to see as a running thread throughout this story, is not just Abraham's desperation for a child that motivates so many of his actions, but his frustration also. And this is going to come together because what we're going to focus on are the steps Abraham takes to ensure he has a kid and how God often frustrates that. So the frustration is working in multiple ways. Abraham is both frustrated with God and God frustrates Abraham. Quite literally, his attempts to, have an heir. Today, we're not really going to look at too much of that part of the narrative because I have a very simple goal for this evening. And that is to reboot our understanding of Abraham. Because the truth is, before we start talking about who Abraham is, before we start getting into the nitty-gritty of his story, we need to have a better appreciation of who he is, rather than, again, the imagined Abraham. And the Abraham that we have kind of added so many layers of interpretation to and so many idealizations of who he is that we have a certain, if I asked you all to kind of picture Avraham in your mind, we'd all picture someone slightly different, but I guess none of us are going to picture the Avraham I am going to describe. And that's not to say all of the Avrahams everyone else would think are wrong, but that is to say that to truly appreciate the story, we need to get a sense of the Peshat Avraham, the Avraham who emerges from a literal reading of the text. And what you're going to see is that we're not really looking at Perushim, we're not looking at Rashi, we're not looking at Midrashim, we're going to quote one Rashi. But what I want to show also is how much can just be illustrated, how much can be gleaned from a close reading of the verses themselves. I mean, if we pay careful attention to what the Torah is telling us, and it already reveals so much, something we don't appreciate, we don't appreciate necessarily enough, is that the Torah is written with a tremendous amount of literary flair. The tools that people often use in kind of other fields to analyze, you know, Shakespeare's plays, can also be used to yield a better appreciation of the Torah's text. And if Shakespeare was good enough to write things a certain way, definitely HaKadosh Baruch Hu was. And so when we pass these psukim through a certain literary lens, we can also just appreciate the complexity and the depth of the Torah. Far from being these cutesy stories that we tell our kids, there is tremendous depth to these stories, and there's also a certain brilliance to how they are constructed. One final thing I had wanted to say on this. Context, very important. And now is not the time to talk about this in any detail whatsoever. But the other thing we always have to realize is that to understand the Peshat of the Torah, we have to imagine ourselves, all the Bnei Yisrael, stood at Har Sinai, hearing the Torah for the first time. And they had a certain set of worldviews. They had a certain set of knowledge they already had acquired about the world. They knew what the world looked like. And the Torah speaks to that world, not explicitly our world. Obviously, we derive from the Torah messages for our own world, but the literal, you know, things it calls to are very much rooted in the world of the Torah, rooted in the world of Bnei Yisrael. You know, if I give an analogy that's the perfect analogy for people in England, you might be at a loss because you're not part of that world. It could be the greatest example in the world, but if it's quintessentially English, it means nothing to you. The Torah uses some brilliant contextual references often that are just lost on us unless we understand the context. And this is going to be really important for understanding who Avraham is. Because again, when I ask you to imagine Avraham, chances are your best attempts at thinking about ancient man living in the ancient world is not necessarily as good a picture as what the Bnei Yisrael would have thought, knowing what those people actually look like. So with that kind of very lengthy introduction, I am going to screen share at this point. Everyone will hopefully see the screen. Does everyone see a source sheet? Can I get, yes, okay, good. Okay, so just kind of the format. Because we're going to be closely reading the Chumash, you'll see here I've kind of have large blocks of text from the Chumash, and then I've bolded key things I want to draw your attention to, and I've also put little footnotes which are going to cross-reference with things as we scroll down. There isn't a great way to do kind of a, I mean, there's no good way to do a parasha share where you're just kind of flicking through the Chumash. That doesn't work. Source sheets kind of fall apart when you're just looking at blocks of text, but we do what we can do with what we have. So here we go. The first thing to bear in mind, the story of Avraham does not begin with Parashat Lech Lecha. This is the great mistake we make, is that we assume that the divides of the Parashiot are narrative blocks. They are not. Why Chazal chose to divide the Parashiyat into what they did, the thematic choices they made, are great, and we should pay attention to them, but they're somewhat artificial. There's a very famous drasha question. I'm sure at some point I'll ask it too, so I'm not mocking those who use it, but there's a classic drasha question of Parashat Tetzaveh, which is, why is Moshe missing from Parashat Tetzaveh? The problem is the question's somewhat artificial because Chazal designed Parashat Tetzaveh to exclude Moshe's name? Perhaps a better question is, why is there a block of text missing Moshe's name in an area of the Torah we'd expect him to occur? But the idea that we should be struck by the fact that Parashat Tetzaveh itself is missing Moshe's name implies there's something divinely ordained about Parashat Tetzaveh, which just isn't true. Chazal created Parashat Tetzaveh. Likewise, and this is maybe more well known, the division even of the Torah into chapters is a Christian invention. That's not to say we don't use it. It's very useful. But again, many of the ways that we divide the Torah aren't natural to the Torah itself. And we have to look sometimes for other clues to indicate, this is the start of a new narrative block. This is grouped together with this. This is a new thing. We finished Parashat Noach. So all of Parashat Noach belongs to Noach. And then we begin Parashat Lech Lecha with the call by God to Avram to make Aliyah. That must be the start of the story. No. The start of the story actually is, as you see in source number one, the end of Parashat Noach, which introduces us to Terach. Verse 26. Vayechi Terach Shivim Shana, the very beginning of source one. Vayoled et Avram et Nachor v'et Haran. We learn that Terach, after he lived 70 years, he had three kids. Not explicitly related to what I want to talk about, but I want to draw your attention to this. This in and of itself is actually a very important verse. One of the problems we suffer from is sometimes called you would call it the omniscient reader. I say the omniscient reader, but it's the same thing. It means all-knowing either way, no matter how you pronounce it. But the omniscient reader is basically, we know what's going to happen. We know this story. There's probably barely been a human alive who has not known at least some of the story of Avraham before they encountered the Torah. There are some people definitely for sure, but most of us know this story before we read it. And so when we read Vayoled et Avram, we know who this is. This is the beginning. Well, here we go. He's a big guy. We know this. But what's actually really important to note is that even if we didn't know this, the Torah, and this goes back to the literary aspect of the Torah highlights for us in a very clever way, something special is about to happen. We learn Terach had three kids. The format of the Torah until now has been predominantly guy has son, that son has, then that guy basically dies, son has a son, that guy dies, and so on and so forth. Obviously, there are women in this story, they're just not being mentioned, and there are ostensibly other kids being mentioned too. But that's not the point of the Torah during this early stage of Sefer Bereishit. It's just there to basically give us essentially the barest bones of a family tree possible, the person who has the kid, and that direct line. There are two exceptions until verse 26. The first is Adam. We read, and I mishmashed a ton of psukim together, but we read it in Exodus source number A. V'ha Adam yada et chava ishto v'tahal v'tilid et Kain. Adam has a kid called Kain. V'tosef laledet et ochiv et Havel. He has a second kid called Havel. V'yichi Adam shloshim u'mat shana v'yolet bidmutok et Salmoid. He has another kid in his image. V'yikra et shmo Sheit. Adam has three kids. Also, chapter 6, verse 10, also in source A. Vayolid Noach Shloisha Vanim et Shem et Ham v'et Yafet. Noach also has three kids, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Until now, only two other people in the Torah have had three kids. Those are kind of the big people in the story until now. Adam is obviously major character of the Torah. Noach, major character of the Torah. All those other people who only have one kid, not major characters. Maybe we get a slight little vignette from their life. All of a sudden, we read, "Vayhi Terach Shivim Shana Vayoled et Avram et Nachor v'et Haran." Three kids. Hold on a second. Again, we know this already, but this is already telling us something significant is about to happen, because the Torah's dropped its father, son, father, son, father, son device, and it's moved to the magic number of three: Adam, Noach, Terach. Those are the three people in the early stages of Sefer Bereishit who get three kids named. Also, all three of them have very similar things happen. Adam has Hevel die. Terach has Haran die. And Noach doesn't have a kid die, but he does curse his son out of existence. Canaan, but Ham by extension, is kind of cursed out of existence. They have three kids who basically, boom, go. And they also have three kids who kind of take center stage. In the case of Adam, it's Shait. He has, you know, he is the line of the future. Noach has Shem, he is the line of the future. And Terach has Avram, who's obviously the line of the future of the story. And then they also have a character who plays a bit part, a kind of exit center right. Cain, bit part, but kind of leaves the story. Japheth has a small part to play, leaves the story. And also Nahor, he kind of leaves the second he's introduced to us. But all three, it's not a perfect one-to-one comparison, but all three children of these three major characters have somewhat similarities in what happens in their narrative, again, indicating there's some sort of relationship here. So the first thing that clues us into the fact that we are reading something important is the fact that we are introduced to Terach, who has three kids. And then we read, V'ela toldot Terach. This is the line of Terach. Terach holid at Avram, at Nahor, v'at Haran, v'Haran holid at Lot. So we get the three kids, then we're introduced to Lot. We'll come back to this. The key thing right now is Ve'ela Toldot Terach. I mentioned already, parashiyot, chapters. There are many artificial ways to divide up the narratives in the Torah. There is one clear indication when we are beginning a narrative unit in Sefer Bereshit, and that's the magic words Ve'ela Toldot. I put them all in source B. The not the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. I don't want to talk about this right now, but I will scream until I'm almost blue in the face that the story of creation that matters for the Torah is the second one, which begins Eila Toldot Hashamayim V'Haaretz B'hi Baram. This is the story, but it's the same Hebrew word. The English is a different translation. It's the same Hebrew word Eila Toldot. These are the generations of the heavens and earth as they were created. Then we also read at the beginning of Noach, new story, Eila Toldot Noach. You can see conceivably how everything until Noach is folded into the story of the birth of the world. Then we read Ve'ela Toldot Terach, okay. Ve'ela Toldot Yitzchak ben Avraham, this is the most famous because it's the beginning of Parashat Toldot, which gives it its name, but we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking it's the only occurrence of Toldot. We are introduced to Yitzchak, with the words that he's already been born, but you get what I'm saying. His narrative kicks off. And then finally, Parashat Vayeshev begins. Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Migurei Aviv Be'eretz Kanaan. Yaakov settled in the land of his father in Kanaan. Eila Toldot Yaakov. This is the line of Yaakov. The next word is actually Yosef. This is an interesting side point, but really Vayeshev, that Eila Toldot Yaakov really begins the Yosef story. The Eila Toldot Yitzchak really begins the Yaakov story. But that's partly because of the kind of person Yitzchak is and his relationship to Yaakov. The key thing for us is that there is no Eila Toldot Avram. It's only Eila Toldot Terach. And then we won't get another Eila Toldot until Yitzchak. And it's important to realize much of the Avraham story is in some way folded into Terach's story. And so these last verses of chapter 11, which comprise source number one, which tell us the story of Terach before we pick up with Avraham as the main character, are crucial for understanding the story that's followed. In verse 27, which I read, we learned already, the Torah let us know, Haran had a kid called Lot, which is important because then we learn Vayamat, verse 28, the end of the third line. Vayamot Haran al pnei Terach Aviv be'eretz moladato ba'or kastim. Haran passes away, unfortunately. But this is important to think about the role of Lot. The Torah already informed us of Lot. He's going to appear again. Lot replaces Haran. Terach effectively adopts Lot. This is going to be very important for next week to remember this. Lot becomes, and this isn't too hard to, you know, please God, this should never be too real to imagine, but it's not hard to imagine, you know, someone loses a son and so essentially takes that son's child as their own to raise, even more so in kind of an ancient society where people are obviously far more, you know, close-knit as family units. Lot becomes the son of Terach. And we read verse 29 tells us about their wives. And what's interesting is this is really the first mentioning of women for a while in the Torah, which again clues us in something special is going to happen. Verse 30, I bolded it. Vatehi Sarai Akara Ein La Valad. And the crucial plot point, we know this is the crucial plot point, but Sarah, Abraham's wife, I'm going to say Sarah and Abraham, even when they're not referred to that in the Torah, she is barren. She has no ability to have a child. This is the crucial plot point the Torah already sets up. Again, it's a familiar one, but it's an important realization because if Sarah can't have kids, that means Abraham can't have kids. We know that, but it's crucial for motivating so much of Abraham's story. And then we read, Vayikach Terach et Avram benav et Lot ben Haran ben Bino. He took Avram and Lot. These are the two kids he's taking with them. Him the et Sarai Kalata, Eshet Avram, Sarah goes with, Vayetzu'u itam me'or kastim, lo lechet artza kanaan. He heads to Israel. Long before Avram is told by God to head to Israel, Terach already wants to go there. Not because of divine command, but for some other reason. Something else motivates him. We'll talk about what that could possibly be shortly. But something else motivates Terach to make Aliyah, to move to the land of Israel. And it's important to realize Abraham's story is somewhat subsumed under Terach's. While Abraham will go to Israel because God commands him, there is a certain element where he is just continuing his father's story. We read, however, Vayavo at Charan Vayeshusham, they arrive in Charan and they decide to settle there. And then famously, as Rashi points out, the Torah tells us Terach died, even though he didn't actually die at this point. He must have lived for much longer. But basically, you know, that's it. That's where they settle. And, you know, we just get the end of the Terach story. What prompts Terach to move, first and foremost? And second, what leads him to settle in Haran? So Chazal famously realized there must have been, I mean, they realize, oh, look, Haran died in their original home. There must have been some sort of traumatic experience that makes them want to leave. Howard, you have a question.
Is there any, the fact that he had a son, Haran, who died, and now they're settling in Haran. Is there any association? Is this something that Haran created?
No, Haran and Haran, I am not a biblical, as I often like to say, I am not a biblical grammar guy. So I don't know, and it's frustrating me because I am sure I read, I don't want to make up that I read something that I didn't read. So I don't want to claim there is a link between Haran and Haran. They happen to be similar names, but they're not connected to one another. Rav Hirsch, whose commentary on the Torah is so important, but also somewhat frustrating because he had his own system of Hebrew grammar, which is based on words that sound like each other. So I am sure he has a lengthy, lengthy thing on the connection between the two. But we are going to see in source number C what Haran means. So source number three is from Nachum Sarna's JPS commentary. As a general, you know, good suggestion, if you are interested in the context of the Torah, and if you are interested in its ancient Near Eastern context, but not in such a, what I might call a religiously threatening way, because a lot of kind of biblical academics, people might find some of their conclusions uncomfortable or unexpected. Nachum Sarna is a kind of, I mean, he's passed away, but he wrote kind of very from, but like academic stuff. So this is from his excellent JPS commentary to the verse we just read, where he explains what Haran is. He says Haran is situated some 550 miles northwest of Ur, so that tells us how far they traveled. And then he tells us it's about 10 miles north of the present-day Syrian-Turkish border on the left bank of the Balikh River, which is less helpful for me than knowing it's 550 miles northwest of Ur, but there you go. The name means route, journey, or caravan, and it doubtless derives from the city's location as an important station along the main international trade routes from Mesopotamia to the Mediterranean Sea. From the Mari archives, it is clear that in the 18th century BCE, that is roughly the time we're expecting that, you know, we assume the Avraham story is taking place, Charan was a center of semi-nomadic Amorite tribes. The reason for Terach's detour is not given, but it may have had to do with Charan as a focus of the international donkey caravan trade, and with the fact that both it and Or were the centers of the moon god cult. A lot to unpack here, but crucial for our understanding of Avraham. So first of all, Terach, also his name, is related to some sort of moon worship. So this is very important to realize. He kind of moves, it's like moving from, you know, somewhere in New Jersey. Like, we move from New Jersey to Boston. We move from one Jewish area to another Jewish area. Now we're in Kansas, another Jewish area. We're not moving to, I don't know. If I say some random place in America, someone's going to be like, actually, I grew up there and it's a vibrant Jewish community, so I'm not going to, you know, but it would be like moving. I'm not even going to try and come up with an analogy, but you get the idea. Terach moved within his religious community almost. He moved from Or, which was a place where they worshipped the god he worshipped, the moon, to Charan, where they also worshipped. More important is the fact that we learn that it is central to donkey caravan trade, and it's the heart of semi-nomadic tribes. First thing to realize, and we're going to double down on this very shortly, when you picture Terach and you picture him crossing to Charan, don't picture a couple of guys on camels moving around. Picture more of a tribe. Picture a group of people. That the Torah doesn't make explicit reference to this kind of ancillary background crowd does not mean they don't exist. It's far more realistic to think of Terach as not just, he's not some random slave. He's not some random guy. Chances are he has some sort of means at his disposal. Donkey caravan would make sense because of how he travels. Something I've not put on this source sheet, so you just have to trust me on this. We're going to read shortly the locations Avraham travels. If you actually chart it out on a map, he travels on the outskirts of cities, which matches the traditional way semi-nomadic donkey caravan trading people would travel. They'd live on the outskirts of cities. They wouldn't actually travel into the city. For many years, people have made the mistake of imagining Avraham as kind of a Bedouin on camels in the middle of a desert. That's wrong. But also don't picture some kind of urban, you know, person. It's a semi-nomadic tribe. That's what we're picturing. Also, I'll mention this at this point, not that it's 100% relevant. We have the famous camel problem, which comes up a lot in Sefer Bereishit, which is that camels were not domesticated around the time we're assuming the Avraham story took place. And this is important because you'll actually realize if you read the Torah closely, camels don't play as important a role as we think they do in the Avraham story. They make a few appearances, but by and large, that's not the main animal he's using to get by. Because, you know, camels weren't generally domesticated. That doesn't mean that the nature of domestication is such that before you have widespread domestication, you'll always have a few people who've domesticated a small number of animals. People often point to Avraham's use of camels as evidence that the story can't take place when it claims to take place because camels weren't domesticated. But no, there's no indication Avraham primarily kind of traveled using camels. Think donkeys and think semi-nomad. Think guy, we know he lives in a tent because we get that in many stories. But he's pitching his tent on the outskirts of towns in places he'd expect people to be traveling, people to be walking past him. That's what Terach does. And Terach settles in. Terach probably leaves Or to head to Canaan for economic reasons. And he settles in Charan because it turns out he was driving cross country and he was deciding he was going to pitch up, you know, move to New York from California. But he discovered in the middle, Chicago. He drove through Chicago for no apparent reason and decided, oh, you know what, I'll actually stay here instead. Terach would not be the first person in the world to have changed the location of where he lived for economic reasons, but end up switching places again. So the important thing to already imagine here, and we're going to double down on this in a second, is that Avraham is the son of Terach, who has, don't think thousands of people, but think group. group of people traveling more than just the kids, a few tents, donkeys, semi-nomads. Which brings us to Parashat Lech Lecha. I am less interested in the beginning. The famous call. We do have three different references to birth, to like home. We have your aretz, your birth, your moladetcha, your birthplace, and your beit avicha, your father's home. Three different levels of a kind of place you'd call home. You know, if you think about it, like people may have a different birthplace than the land they call home, and then the place that they consider kind of their parents' home. People can live, people can have lots of different locations. Avram is being asked to leave all three. And what's also very interesting, I'm going to mention this again definitely in a couple of weeks when we take a look at the Akedah briefly, the story of Avram is actually bookended with him severing ties with his father and also being asked to literally sever ties with his son. He doesn't with Yitzchak, but it's actually the beginning of the story. Both have the command Lech Lecha in them also. Both Lech Lecha commands here at the beginning and also at the end with the Akedah are to leave your family behind, which is fascinating. I don't really want to dwell on that, but I just want to point it out because it's cool. And God tells him, verse number two, I'm going to make you great. And this is really important. God is promising Abraham things. It's really important to remember this. God has said he's going to do things for him. You'll be a source of blessing for people. And then the key thing here is, I'm going to make you a great nation. This is obviously going to be very important because Avram, as we already learned, Sarah can't have kids. So the way in which he's made into a great nation is going to be key to understanding how that's going to happen. The key thing is verse 4, Vayelech Avram ka'asher diber elav Adonai, Vayelech ito Lot. Lot goes with Avram at this point. What I'd argue, and next week we're going to see this, I think, even clearer, Lot at this point needs to be understood as the heir of Avraham. Avraham is moving from Terach, but he's basically, you know, he's bringing a lot with him, as we're just about to read. And Lot goes with him. In other words, the focus of the family, the leader of the family, the tribal chief, is no longer going to be Terach, but Avram. And Terach had adopted Lot as his successor, and now Avram takes Lot with him. Lot is, and this is not uncommon in the times of the Torah, for people to have both biological relationships and legal relationships. And this most famously comes on a story we're not going to read in any detail, which is the Abraham asks Sarah to claim she's his sister, and much ink has been spilled pointing out that it's not a simple kind of just say you're my sister, but it's the term sister is a legal category of person, and one could be married to their legal sister, and that it connotes a certain set of protections, and it connotes a certain amount of things, and all these, we're not going to get into that, but that's just something to bear in mind. Lot is in, can be seen as, and Lot is sometimes described in the Torah as Avram's brother, see it as, in some ways, Lot is the heir to the throne of Terach. It's not an actual throne, but that was very dramatic. But you get the point. Lot is heir to Terach. Avram is now taking over from Terach. Avram has no kids. It's important to always remember, Lot is the heir at this point. That's going to pay dividends next week. Lot is Avram's heir. Lot is the heir to Terach and the heir to Avram. We learn that Avram ben Chamesh Shanim v'shivim shana b'tzeitach u'mecharan. He's 75. Verse 5. Vayikach Avram et Sarai ishta v'et Lot ben Achiv v'et kol ruchusham asher rachashu v'et hanech asher asu v'charan. They take with all the wealth that they had amassed and all the persons they had acquired in Charan. So first of all, wealth, let's just note that. Chances are it's not just Avram, but it's also Terach, but the point is he's moving the family business. But they already have wealth at this point. And we learn that there are people, famously, We often translate this the way Art School encouraged the translation, because it's a very midrashic translation. Nefesh is souls. And what does it mean? Ve'et ha-nefesh asher asu v'charan, all the people they converted, all the people they made religious, all the souls they spiritually uplifted. Nefesh in the Torah generally means actually something physical. The idea that nefesh means our soul is actually is not a biblical Hebrew word. Even in Tehillim, if you actually look at the occurrence of nefesh, it often means throat. Nefesh means, often if you think of some of the, I knew them off the top of my head until obviously I started speaking just now, but often in the Torah, when we find the word nefesh, it actually means a physical body. Nefesh is actually not something spiritual, it's something physical. What are all these nefashot asher asu v'charan? What are all these people they've acquired in Haran? Well, perhaps it's slaves, or perhaps it's just more generally kind of that entourage. Again, picture tribal chief. What does a tribal chief have around him? A tribe. It's not just Avram and Lot and Sarah moving here. It's a whole procession of people. So just to clarify, because I got a question. I got a question wanting to just re-explain what I mean by Lot is the heir to Terach. So the idea is here, what I'm stressing with Lot is that Terach's heir are his kids. Nahor's dropped out of the picture. So we now have Avram and Lot. They are the only two kids left in the picture. Avraham is not going to have any kids at this point in the story. And he's also older than Lot, so we can just make kind of the assumption Lot is essentially going to inherit everything when Avraham passes also. Just as Avraham has now taken, essentially, ve'et kol ruchusham asher achashu, that's everything Terach also, he's taken everything with, he's also bringing Lot. Lot is the heir. Just as Lot was the heir, one of the heirs to Terach, along with Avraham, that also makes him the heir to Avraham, and the lone heir to Avraham. We read Vayitzu lalechet arta Kanaan, Vayivor arta Kanaan. Fine, they head to Kanaan. There's a really wonderful, wonderful depiction of the kind of person we can imagine Avraham is, which really puts all of this together, and which comes from a book called The World of the Bible by a guy called John Drain. You're going to see in a second when I show you the screenshots. There's yellow because I found it on Google Books. It was actually a friend of mine who found it on Google Books for me. A word of warning before we read it. There's nothing wrong with what we are about to read, but whenever you are wanting to delve into the world of kind of more of biblical study, there are a few things you want to watch out for. One is, as I already mentioned, some people can find academic biblical study uncomfortable because of the assumptions it makes, because of the premises it works with, which often don't work well with an orthodox mindset, with a religious mindset. So it's one thing to always be aware of. For me, that doesn't bother me. I feel that I can often gain a lot from something, even if some of the premises I reject. But that's one thing to bear in mind. But I'd encourage caution when you're kind of reading a book by an academic scholar. On the flip side, if the academic scholar is a Christian, that's just more reason for caution. Because before you know it, you're reading a book about the Bible. And obviously, they also make, again, there are from Jews who write biblical stuff, serious biblical stuff, and their orthodoxy just pours through every page. They can't help it. So obviously, if you're reading something by a Christian scholar, that's not to discount his scholarship, but it's sometimes they can make statements and sometimes they can read the story in ways that we don't read the story. Now's not the time to talk about this in any detail, but I'll just throw this out here. Yes, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all trace a relationship back to Avraham, but the Avraham we extract from these stories is fundamentally different. And the episodes that we put so much significance in are often different episodes, and the messages we learn from these stories are often also different. So you always just want to be careful. If you found a book that looks interesting, like The World of the Bible, do a bit of Googling to find out who wrote it. And if you read, like, John Drain is the most religious man in the world, and he's a devout Christian, and he's, you know, always there in his church every day, don't not read it, but just proceed with slight caution. In this particular case, obviously there's nothing. If there was something disturbing, I would either call it outright or just wouldn't put it here. But he says something very interesting, which I've included the whole thing here. Source number D. Closer examination of the stories about Avraham reveals a pattern of life that reflects the semi-nomadic pastoral existence that is so well documented elsewhere. Avraham is clearly represented as one of the more successful nomads. He is the owner of large flocks and has considerable wealth at his disposal. Even the food he eats provides evidence for his prosperity. When a meal has to be prepared in haste to feed some unexpected visitors, it includes cake, a calf, curds, and milk. That's the beginning of Parashat Vayera. This menu is remarkably similar to the sort of food that was expected by Sinu, and I don't know how to pronounce that, so I just went for it, an Egyptian aristocrat who lived in Canaan for a while. As we get this quote, bread was made for me as daily fare, wine as daily provision, cooked meat and roast fowl, beside the wild beasts of the desert, and milk in every kind of cooking. Next column, like other well-to-do semi-nomads, Avraham and later members of his clan generally camped near to smallish settlements, sometimes staying for long enough to become farmers, and at times of particular stringency, they could even become city dwellers for a while. All those footnotes, which I didn't include, are various stories about Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Yosef, where basically they do all these things. And as the story unfolds, his descendants, Yitzhak and Yaakov, gradually adopt a more settled existence until Yaakov is persuaded to migrate permanently to Egypt and adopt a far more urbanized lifestyle altogether. Avraham could also command large numbers of men and was able to call on the services of what was in effect a private army, which he used to great effect in rescuing his nephew Lot from captivity. Yes, there's the famous Chazal, it's Eliezer, but the pshat is it's just a lot of people. The many kings mentioned in that connection correlate well with the description of the political organization described in the letter from Mary, dating shortly after 1800 BCE. That's the one thing you have to watch out for. We know he's Christian because he writes BC. There you go, BCE. This just underscores everything I'm trying to say and gives a few more examples so that I don't, you know, bludgeon everyone to death with all of these examples from the Torah. Whatever you were picturing of Avraham before this shir, this is what you now picture. Leader of tribe, tribal chieftain. That's why he's comfortable. Like, think of the stories, like either, and again, this is kind of a broader rule. The question is, how fanciful do we have to accept the story? How much do we have to suspend our disbelief when it comes to the narratives of the Torah? Maybe suspend disbelief is the wrong word, but accept a higher level of belief. But when Avraham talks to kings, when Avraham goes, saves all these cities, you know, repels forces, as we read in this week's parasha, either we have to kind of really, really think this guy is truly magical and wonderful, unless we think, oh, he's a semi-nomadic tribal chief. It's not uncommon for semi-nomadic tribal chief to get involved in battle in order to save someone. And at the same time, in order to help, and he ends up interacting with kings and other tribal chiefs. It makes sense. If Avraham, it's like the president will end up meeting, you know, the king of some tiny small country as part of a state visit, because that's what they do. The king of, I don't know if Liechtenstein has a king, but whoever the leader of Liechtenstein is, it doesn't matter that Liechtenstein is this tiny little country. The leader of Liechtenstein ends up meeting the other leaders of the world. That's how it works. You know, the Queen of England meets the tribal chiefs that are kind of still under technically her domain. That's how it works. They don't meet randos. They don't meet random people who just happen to be wandering around for no apparent reason, halfway lost with their family. Again, we either have to accept an even grander depiction of Avraham in order to make this story work, or alternatively, we have to realize, no, he is being situated in a period in time, and we are describing a figure at this point who has wealth, has means, and is a someone. That's who Avraham is. So whatever we picture Avraham to be, this is the Avraham we must imagine. And you can already imagine, while obviously the need to pass on his legacy is important, if this is the Avraham we picture, it gains greater political significance also, because everything a tribal chieftain needs is to pass on things to his heir. He needs to keep the, you know, keep the tribe going. And this is far more important. Yes, if Avram's just some random dude with his family, okay, that's still important, obviously. But it's even more important if he has some sort of political significance to himself. This explains why when Avram travels into places, you know, he is greeted. It's why, you know, the king, yes, the king of Egypt falls in love with Sarah's beauty, but it's why, like, why would, you know, you can imagine, and we're not actually going to read this story, but you can, we're going to see it in a second, parts of it. You can imagine the number of people who traveled into Egypt every day, and, you know, the women were attractive. It's very hard to imagine that every single time, you know, someone beautiful was kind of around, they genuinely reserved it for the power. It's, again, it becomes more plausible if we realize, well, this is an important guy. This is someone who's being received. You know, they see not just him and Sarah and Lot traveling down to Egypt. They see an entire entourage. It's like the Prince Ali song from Aladdin. You know, he's walking into Egypt and then it's like, oh, okay, all of a sudden, this is an important person. So now we're going to kind of, you know, give Sarah to Pharaoh, to Para. And, you know, that's why Avraham interacts with kings. So we understand who Avraham is. He is a wealthy tribal chief of some significance. Not also, by the way, if you're God and you want to start a religion, you wouldn't just choose like random person. You would choose at least someone with something going for him, you'd imagine. Okay, what I want to dwell on very briefly is the relationship God has with Avraham. Because this is something we're going to see, this is important just to emphasize. God rarely appears to Avraham. Even when the story picks up with Avraham when he's 75, I mentioned already the word vignettes. We don't get Avraham's life from 75 through until his death. We get years go by at certain parts of this story, and we're going to see that. But periods of time go by. Remember, Yishmael is born, and then we pick up with Yishmael at 13. Ostensibly, nothing's happened in between. There's a 13-year gap where God's not spoken to Avraham. And we're going to see very clearly Avraham's relationship with God and the first seeds of frustration in the first real story of Avraham. So we read verse number 6. This is the continuation. Avraham arrives in the land of Canaan. Vayavo Avraham ba'aretz. I like the instinct to lane this because it's like so well known as laning. But Vayavo Avraham ba'aretz ad mekom Shechem ad Elon Moreh. He arrives where he is, the terebinth of Moreh. Vahaknani az ba'aretz, one of the most controversial phrases in the entire Torah. That was when the Canaanim were in the land. There's the famous Ibn Ezra, that this is a gloss the Torah added later because, you know, that was when the Canaanim were in the land. Implies it's a time after the Canaanim have been destroyed, which must be after the time of the Torah. We'll talk about that another time, but just file that away. Three of the most controversial words in the Torah. Vayera Adonai el Avram. God appears. I'm giving this to your offspring. By the way, who is his offspring at this point? Lot. And God, Avraham builds a mizbeach in recognition that God appeared to him. The assumption at this point is basically Avraham's been wandering around in a general direction. And now God appears as the, you know, the GPS, you've reached your destination. And that's when he finally appears. What does Avraham next do? Well, if you were told by God, go to a land, it's going to be yours, and God's like, you're here, the next thing you're going to do is, well, you know, Avraham didn't have a map of the land of Israel. It's not like he knew the exact geography and its boundaries. So the next thing you're going to do is you've just learned. You have this kind of magical God who announced when you'd reached your destination. So you're kind of going to test it out. You're going to start traveling around trying to figure out, you know, what is the extent of your land. So we read, Vayatek misham hahara mikedem levet el vayet ahala. He moves further, pitches his tent. Beit el miyam vahoy mikedem. We get the direction. Vayiven sham mizbeach ladonai vayikrav v'shem adonai. And then he builds another mizbeach and invokes God by name. What's he expecting to happen at this point? What happened the last time? It was in reverse order. But God appeared to him, and Avraham built a mizbeach. So now he kind of wants to know, am I still here? Hello, God, can I speak to you again? He does what he did last time that worked. He calls out God's name. Do we get a pasuk Vayayma Hashem el Avram? No, nothing happens. What happens next? Vayisa Avram Haloch Vanasoa Hanegba. He journeyed by stages towards the Negev. As Rashi, this is the one Rashi because it's just a brilliant explanation of Pshat. Lifrakim Yoshev Kan Chodesh Oyota. He stayed, you know, a month or so in each place. Vanosami Sham Venote Alaba Makamached and moved his tent to another location. Vachol Masa'av Hanegba Lalechel Idroma Shel Eretz Yisrael. And then he headed south. And then Rashi goes on a bit of an explanation about Yerushalayim, which I didn't put in. Avraham is moving around. The Torah doesn't say so explicitly, but I'd bet money that he's building a mizbeach at each of these locations. Avraham is wandering around trying to find the extent of his land. He's moving around. He's a nomad. He's sticking with the cities, near the cities, but he's moving around his land uncertain of what it is. Vayihi ra'av ba'aretz. Vayered Avram Mitzrayim ala Gorsham ki choved hara'av ba'aretz. Imagine for a second, so we learn famine struck and Avram moves to Egypt, moves down to where there's no more famine. Imagine for a second you are Avram. God told you pack up everything, move, so you did. And then you arrive in your new destination and it's like, great, you found your destination. You obviously realize it's more than just this location, so you start moving. You start building mizbechot everywhere, calling out God's name to no response. And then a famine hits. What's your first instinct? What the famine symbolize? Famines are God's disapproval. If all of a sudden all sources of food dry up, your reaction is, God doesn't want me here. That's, you know, the famous Ramban, which I love to quote, everyone loves to quote, where he criticizes Avram for not having faith in God. But the truth is, like, famines are almost universally seen in the Torah as an indication of sin, as an indication of a problem, that of punishment. God doesn't want you here, so he kicks you out by making it impossible for you to live here any longer. Avraham is forced to move. He takes the natural route, but at this point, God has basically abandoned him. The story that I put in the ellipses is the famous story of the wife-sister switch. We see Avraham take some initiative. It's actually important to also note, Avraham likes taking initiative. He likes doing things on his own volition. It doesn't really end up, but he seems stuck in Egypt. He's very wealthy, but his wife has been captured by Paro until verse 17. Vaynaga Adonai et Paro negaim gedolim ve'et beito. God strikes Paro al davasarei eshep Avram. And then we have the rest of the story, which is Paro, you know, realizes, oh, God afflicted me. God has not appeared to Avraham, except to tell him he's reached his destination. Avram's kind of traveled. He's gone too far, basically. He's gone past his land. God bails Avraham out at this point. But that's the extent of their relationship. It's like the equivalent of, you know, sending off a kid to live elsewhere and you give them the emergency credit card. That's basically, but otherwise you're not going to talk to them. That's basically the relationship Avraham has with God. God only appeared to make sure no one got into too much trouble. And remember the link here. For next week, it's going to be important. Avraham took initiative because God ain't doing anything for himself. So Avraham took initiative. Things went wrong. God bailed him out. What happens next? The next perek we read, Vaya'al Avraham Mitzrayim ahu ve'ishto b'chol asher lo ve'lot imo hanegba. They head out of Egypt. They head north. Lot is with him. He's very wealthy. He has everything with him. Va'avraham kovid ma'od ba'megneba kesef v'vazav. He's got a lot of wealth. Vayelach lemasaf. They proceeded by stages minegev v'ad beit el ad hamakom asher hayasham ahalob atchila until the original place he'd pitched his tent. It clearly takes them a while. Bein beit el or bein ha'ai, the same location we'd learned about earlier. El makom hamizbeach asher asah sham barishana. He goes back to the mizbeach that had been there at the beginning. Vayikra sham Avram b'shem Adonai. And he once again calls out. Why? Avraham reverses everything. He realized at some point he goofed. At some point he did something wrong. But he doesn't know what. We can ostensibly assume he's once again putting mizbachot, calling out to God's name, trying to, you know, get cell service to God. And so basically he just retraces all of his steps. This initial story is a really sad story. Avraham arrives in the land of Israel, enthusiastic. God's like, you're here. And then for the next however long, we can imagine it's a significant period of his life. It's probably, you know, realistically, if he's journeying by stages down to Israel with a whole retinue, staying for a while in each location, it's going to take a year or two. I'm not going to, you know, a while to achieve nothing. He's had no contact with God, save that initial time. And, you know, that's it. God bailed him out. But apart from that, that's it. It's like, you know, when I moved to YU, and you're like, you know, it's all exciting at first, but then like you kind of arrive in your room and there's just like silence because there's nothing else around you. And it's like, oh, all that enthusiasm is kind of, that went away. All the enthusiasm and excitement, Avraham heading to the land of Israel, and then silence. And so this is the other thing I want to draw your attention to set up for the next couple of weeks. Avraham is a wealthy guy. He's a tribal chief. That's what we need to imagine. The fact that most of the people don't appear most often in the Torah doesn't matter because that's the nature of the Torah. It only tells you important characters when they appear. For another reason, a friend of mine pointed out, you know, the most extreme example of this is when Adam and Chava are kicked out of Gan Eden. The Torah only tells us Adam is kicked out, not Chava, even though she's obviously with him, because the Torah is a very, very, like, you know, it tells you people when you need to know. It keeps on drawing our attention to Lot, because Lot is the heir to Avram at this point. He's going to inherit everything. He's going to be the guy who succeeds Avram. Avram's relationship with God is a bit iffy. God does not seem to be so communicative to him, apart from that first time. And whenever Avram has taken the initiative, whenever Avram takes the initiative is going to be something we're going to learn next week. But Avram has taken the initiative and it fails, and God bailed him out, but otherwise there's no contact. And Avram at this point is defeated. Far from being the Avraham we think of, who's like best friends with God. Oh, they're always in communication with one another. He knows everything at all times. No, that's not the Avram that the Torah describes at the beginning. Far from it. And so it's important. One thing I'll say as an aside, but an important aside, is that we often think of Avraham as kind of this unachievable, unrealistic, how could we ever see ourselves as Avraham? But maybe starting to see Avraham as a guy who God doesn't really talk to. And I have a drusha about this. I'll share another time when I'm giving a drusha. So I don't want to spoil it now by sharing it. But why do one thing when you eke out two? But the fact is, Avraham suddenly becomes a lot more relatable. Because, like, you know, apart from God actually appearing to Avraham, I feel like most of us wander through life like this. We kind of wander around, we do things, we feel like God bailed us out of things that maybe were really bad, but otherwise we're just kind of floating around, you know, unaware of what's going on. That's Avraham at this point. That's the Avraham we need to realize. That's his relationship with God. And so as we move next week to looking at the first of what we're basically going to see is that Avraham has four sons. Avraham's four different people who at one point or another will be his heir, who are either rejected or he must reject. And we're obviously going to begin with the one we've been acquainted with until now, Lot. And a lot of the story of Lot that then comes after the story that we're going to lay in this week's parasha, or Noam White's going to lay in for us in this week's parasha, is motivated by everything we've talked about today. Who Avraham is, what the stakes are for him in needing to have a child, and also that his relationship with God is iffy at the best and is hardly the relationship we think of when we imagine Avraham.